attribute the fragilizing effect of contemporary globalization to complexity, and how connectivity and cultural contagions make gyrations in economic variables much more severe, the classic switch to extremistan. But there is another effect, wealth. Wealth means more, and because of nonlinear scaling, more is different. We are prone to make more severe errors because we are simply wealthier. Just as projects of $100 million are more unpredictable and more likely to incur overruns than $5 million ones, simply by being richer, the world is troubled with additional unpredictability and fragility. This comes with growth. At a country level, this highly dreamed of GDP growth. Even at an individual level, wealth means more headaches. We may need to work harder at mitigating the complications arising from wealth than we do at acquiring it. Conclusion. To conclude this chapter, fragility in any domain, from a porcelain cup to an organism, to a political system, to the size of a firm, or to delays in airports, resides in the nonlinear. Further, discovery can be seen as anti-deficit. Think of the exact opposite of airplane delays or project overruns, something that benefits from uncertainty. And discovery presents the mirror image of what we saw as fragile, randomness-hating situations. Chapter 19. The Philosopher's Stone. Deeper into convexity. How Fannie Mae went bust. Non-linearity. The heuristic to detect fragility and anti-fragility. Convexity biases, Jensen's inequality, and their impact on ignorance. The Philosopher's Stone and its inverse. They tell you when they are going bust. Gold is sometimes a special variety of lead. And now, listener, after the Herculean effort I put into making the ideas of the last few chapters clearer to you, my turn to take it easy and express things technically, sort of. Accordingly, this chapter, a deepening of the ideas of the previous ones, will be denser and should be skipped by the enlightened listener. How to detect who will go bust. Let us examine a method to detect fragility, the inverse philosopher's stone. We can illustrate it with the story of the giant government-sponsored lending firm called Fannie Mae, a corporation that collapsed, leaving the United States taxpayer with hundreds of billions of dollars of losses, and alas, still counting. One day in 2003, Alex Berenson, a New York Times journalist, came into my office with the secret risk reports of Fannie Mae, given to him by a defector. It was the kind of report getting into the guts of the methodology for risk calculation that only an insider can see. Fannie Mae made its own risk calculations and disclosed what it wanted to whomever it wanted, the public or someone else. But only a defector could show us the guts to see how the risk was calculated. We looked at the report. Simply, a move upward in an economic variable led to massive losses, a move downward in the opposite direction to small profits. Further moves upward led to even larger additional losses, and further moves downward to even smaller profits. Acceleration of harm was obvious. In fact, it was monstrous. So we immediately saw that their blow-up was inevitable. Their exposures were severely concave, similar to the traffic example earlier. Losses that accelerate as one deviates economic variables. I did not even need to understand which one, as fragility to one variable of this magnitude implies fragility to all other parameters. I worked with my emotions, not my brain, and I had a pang before even understanding what numbers I had been looking at. It was the mother of all fragilities, and, thanks to Berenson, the New York Times presented my concern. A smear campaign ensued, but nothing too notable, for I had in the meantime called a few key people charlatans, and they were not too excited about it. The key is that the nonlinear is vastly more affected by extreme events, and nobody was interested in extreme events since they had a mental block against them. I kept telling anyone who would listen to me, including random taxi drivers, well, almost, that the company Fannie Mae was sitting on a barrel of dynamite. Of course, blow-ups don't happen every day, just as poorly built bridges don't collapse immediately. and people kept saying that my opinion was wrong and unfounded, using some argument that the stock was going up or something even more circular. I also inferred that other institutions, almost all banks, were in the same situation. After checking similar institutions and seeing that the problem was general, I realized that a total collapse of the banking system was a certainty. I was so certain I could not see straight and went back to the markets to get my revenge against the turkeys. As in the scene from The Godfather 3, just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in. Things happened as if they were planned by destiny. Fannie Mae went bust, along with other banks. It just took a bit longer than expected. No big deal. The stupid part of the story is that I had not seen the link between financial and general fragility, nor did I use the term fragility. Maybe I didn't look at too many porcelain cups. However, thanks to the episode of The Attic, I had a measure for fragility, hence anti-fragility. It all boils down to the following. Figuring out if our miscalculations or misforecasts are on balance more harmful than they are beneficial, and how accelerating the damage is. Exactly as in the story of the king, in which the damage from a 10-kilogram stone is more than twice the damage from a 5-kilogram one. Such accelerating damage means that a large stone would eventually kill the person. Likewise, a large market deviation would eventually kill the company. Once I figured out that fragility was directly from nonlinearity and convexity effects, and that convexity was measurable, I got all excited. The technique, detecting acceleration of harm, applies to anything that entails decision-making under uncertainty and risk management. While it was the most interesting in medicine and technology, the immediate demand was in economics. So I suggested to the International Monetary Fund a measure of fragility to substitute for their measures of risk that they knew didn't work. Most people in the risk business had been frustrated by the poor, rather the random, performance of their models. But they didn't like my earlier stance, don't use any model. They wanted something. And a risk measure was there. The method does not require a good model for risk measurement. Take a ruler. You know it is wrong. It will not be able to measure the height of the child, but it can certainly tell you if he is growing. In fact, the error you get about the rate of growth of the child is much, much smaller than the error you would get measuring his height. The same with a scale. No matter how defective, it will almost always be able to tell you if you are gaining weight, so stop blaming it. Convexity is about acceleration. The remarkable thing about measuring convexity effects to detect model errors is that even if the model used for the computation is wrong, it can tell you if an entity is fragile and by how much it is fragile. As with the defective scale, we are only looking for second-order effects. So here is something to use. The technique, a simple heuristic called the fragility and anti-fragility detection heuristic, works as follows. Let's say you want to check whether a town is over-optimized. Say you measure that when traffic increases by 10,000 cars, travel time grows by 10 minutes. But if traffic increases by 10,000 more cars, travel time now extends by an extra 30 minutes. Such acceleration of traffic time shows that traffic is fragile and you have too many cars and need to reduce traffic until the acceleration becomes mild. Acceleration, I repeat, is acute concavity, or negative convexity effect. Likewise, government deficits are particularly concave to changes in economic conditions. Every additional deviation in, say, the unemployment rate, particularly when the government has debt, makes deficits incrementally worse. And financial leverage for a company has the same effect. You need to borrow more and more to get the same effect, just as in a Ponzi scheme. The same with operational leverage on the part of a fragile company. Should sales increase 10%, then profits would increase less than they would decrease should sales drop 10%. That was, in a way, the technique I used intuitively to declare that the highly respected firm Fannie Mae was on its way to the cemetery, and it was easy to produce a rule of thumb out of it. Now, with the IMF, we had a simple measure with a stamp. It looked simple, too simple. So the initial reaction from experts was that it was trivial, said by people who visibly never detected these risks before Academics and quantitative analysts scorn what they can understand too easily and get ticked off by what they did not think of themselves. According to the wonderful principle that one should use people's stupidity to have fun, I invited my friend Raphael Douadi to collaborate in expressing this simple idea using the most opaque mathematical derivations with incomprehensible theorems that would take half a day for a professional to understand. Raphael, Bruno De Pier, and I have been involved in an almost 2-decades-long continuous conversation on how everything entailing risk, everything, can be seen with a lot more rigor and clarity from the vantage point of an option professional. Raphael and I managed to prove the link between nonlinearity, dislike of volatility, and fragility. Remarkably, as has been shown, if you can say something straightforward in a complicated manner with complex theorems, even if there is no large gain in rigor from these complicated equations, people take the idea very seriously. We got nothing but positive reactions, and we were now told that this simple detection heuristic was intelligent by the same people who had found it trivial. The only problem is that mathematics is addictive. The idea of positive and negative model error. Now, what I believe is my true specialty, error in models. When I was in the transaction business, I used to make plenty of errors of execution. You buy 1,000 units, and in fact, you discover the next day that you bought 2,000. If the price went up in the meantime, you had a handsome profit. Otherwise, you had a large loss. So these errors are in the long run neutral in effect, since they can affect you both ways. They increase the variance, but they don't affect your business too much. There is no one-sidedness to them. And these errors can be kept under control thanks to size limits. You make a lot of small transactions, so errors remain small. And at year-end, typically, the errors wash out, as they say. But that is not the case with most things we build, and with errors related to things that are fragile in the presence of negative convexity effects. This class of errors has a one-way outcome, that is, negative, and tends to make planes land later, not earlier. Wars tend to get worse, not better. As we saw with traffic, variations, now called disturbances, tend to increase travel time from South Kensington to Piccadilly Circus, never shorten it. Some things, like traffic, do rarely experience the equivalent of positive disturbances. This one-sidedness brings both underestimation of randomness and underestimation of harm, since one is more exposed to harm than benefit from error. If in the long run we get as much variation in the source of randomness one way as the other, the harm would severely outweigh the benefits. So, and this is the key to the triad, we can classify things by three simple distinctions. Things that, in the long run, like disturbances or errors, things that are neutral to them, and those that dislike them. By now we have seen that evolution likes disturbances. We saw that discovery likes disturbances. Some forecasts are hurt by uncertainty, and, like travel time, one needs a buffer. Airlines figured out how to do it, but not governments, when they estimate deficits. This method is very general. I even used it with Fukushima-style computations and realized how fragile their computation of small probabilities was. In fact, all small probabilities tend to be very fragile to errors, as a small change in the assumptions can make the probability rise dramatically, from 1 per million to 1 per 100. Indeed, a 10,000-fold underestimation. Finally, this method can show us where the math and economic models is bogus, which models are fragile and which ones are not. Simply do a small change in the assumptions and look at how large the effect, and if there is acceleration of such effect. Acceleration implies, as with Fannie Mae, that someone relying on the model blows up from black swan effects. Molto facile. What I can say for now is that much of what is taught in economics that has an equation, as well as econometrics, should be immediately ditched, which explains why economics is largely a charlatanic profession. Fragilistas, semper fragilisti. How to lose a grandmother. Next, I will explain the following effect of nonlinearity, conditions under which the average, the first-order effect, does not matter, as a first step before getting into the workings of the Philosopher's Stone. As the saying goes, do not cross a river if it is on average 4 feet deep. You have just been informed that your grandmother will spend the next 2 hours at the very desirable average temperature of 70 degrees Fahrenheit, about 21 degrees Celsius. Excellent, you think, since 70 degrees is the optimal temperature for grandmothers. Since you went to business school, you are a big-picture type of person and are satisfied with the summary information. But there is a second piece of data. Your grandmother, it turns out, will spend the first hour at 0 degrees Fahrenheit, around minus 18 Celsius, and the second hour at 140 degrees, around 60 degrees Celsius, for an average of the very desirable Mediterranean-style 70 degrees, 21 degrees Celsius. So it looks as though you will most certainly end up with no grandmother, a funeral, and possibly an inheritance. Clearly, temperature changes become more and more harmful as they deviate from 70 degrees. As you see, the second piece of information, the variability, turned out to be more important than the first. The notion of average is of no significance when one is fragile to variations. The dispersion and possible thermal outcomes here matters much more. Your grandmother is fragile to variations of temperature, to the volatility of the weather. Let us call that second piece of information the second-order effect, or more precisely, the convexity effect. Here, consider that, as much as a good simplification the notion of average can be, it can also be a Procrustean bed. The information that the average temperature is 70 degrees Fahrenheit does not simplify the situation for your grandmother. It is information squeezed into a Procrustean bed, and these are necessarily committed by scientific modelers, since a model is by its very nature a simplification. You just don't want the simplification to distort the situation to the point of being harmful. I can graph the fragility of the health of the grandmother to variations. If I plot health on the vertical axis and temperature on the horizontal one, I see a shape that curves inward, a concave shape or negative convexity effect. If the grandmother's response was linear, no curve, a straight line, then the harm of temperature below 70 degrees would be offset by the benefits of temperature above it. And the fact is that the health of the grandmother has to be capped at a maximum, otherwise she would keep improving. Take this for now as we rapidly move to the more general attributes. In the case of the grandmother's health response to temperature, A, there is non-linearity. The response is not a straight line, not linear. B, it curves inward, too much so. And finally, C, the more nonlinear the response, the less relevant the average, and the more relevant the stability around such average. Now the Philosopher's Stone. Much of medieval thinking went into finding the Philosopher's Stone. It is always good to be reminded that chemistry is the child of alchemy, much of which consisted of looking into the chemical powers of substances. The main efforts went into creating value by transforming metals into gold by the method of transmutation. The necessary substance was called the Philosopher's Stone, Lapis Philosophorum. Many people fell for it, a list that includes such scholars as Albertus Magnus, Isaac Newton, and Roger Bacon, and great thinkers who were not quite scholars, such as Paracelsus. It is a matter of no small import that the operation of transmutation was called the Magnus Opus, the greatest work. I truly believe that the operation I will discuss, based on some properties of optionality, is about as close as we can get to the Philosopher's Stone. The following note would allow us to understand, A, the severity of the problem of conflation, mistaking the price of oil for geopolitics, or mistaking a profitable bet for good forecasting, not convexity of payoff and optionality. B. Why anything with optionality has a long-term advantage, and how to measure it. C. The merger of the 2 points above, conflation and optionality. Recall from our traffic example in Chapter 18 that 90,000 cars for an hour, then 110,000 cars for the next one, for an average of 100,000, and traffic will be horrendous. On the other hand, assume we have 100,000 cars for 2 hours, and traffic will be smooth and time in traffic short. The number of cars is the something, a variable. Traffic time is the function of something. The behavior of the function is such that it is, as we said, not the same thing. We can see here that the function of something becomes different from the something under nonlinearities. A. The more nonlinear, the more the function of something divorces itself from the something. If traffic were linear, then there would be no difference in traffic time between the two following situations. 90,000, then 110,000 cars on the one hand, or 100,000 cars on the other. B. The more volatile the something, the more uncertainty, the more the function divorces itself from the something. Let us consider the average number of cars again. The function, travel time, depends more on the volatility around the average. Things degrade if there is evenness of distribution. For the same average, you prefer to have 100,000 cars for both time periods. 80,000 then 120,000 would be even worse than 90,000 and 110,000. C. If the function is convex, antifragile, then the average of the function of something is going to be higher than the function of the average of something. This is the philosopher's stone, and the reverse when the function is concave, fragile. As an example, assume that the function under question is the squaring function, multiply a number by itself. This is a convex function. Take a conventional die, 6 sides, and consider a payoff equal to the number it lands on. That is, you get paid a number equivalent to what the die shows, 1 if it lands on 1, 2 if it lands on 2, up to 6 if it lands on 6. The square of the expected average payoff is then the quantity of 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 plus 6 divided by 6 squared equals 3.5 squared, here 12.25. So the function of the average equals 12.25. But the average of the function is as follows. Take the square of every payoff, 1 squared plus 2 squared plus 3 squared plus 4 squared plus 5 squared plus 6 squared, divided by 6, that is, the average square payoff, and you can see that the average of the function equals 15.67. So, since squaring is a convex function, the average of the square payoff is higher than the square of the average payoff. The difference here between 15.67 and 12.25 is what I call the hidden benefit of antifragility. Here, a 28% edge. This is the convexity bias, the philosopher's stone. The conflation problem, mistaking a property of a function of something for the function of the property of something, leads to severe misunderstanding of the process. Someone with a linear payoff needs to be right more than 50% of the time. Someone with a convex payoff, much less. The hidden benefit of antifragility is that you can guess worse than random and still end up outperforming. Here lies the power of optionality. Your function of something is very convex, so you can be wrong and still do fine. The more uncertainty, the better. This explains my statement that you can be dumb and anti-fragile and still do very well. This convexity bias comes from a mathematical property called Jensen's inequality. This is what the common discourse on innovation is missing. If you ignore the convexity bias, you are missing a chunk of what makes the nonlinear world go round. And it is a fact that such an idea is missing from the discourse. Sorry. How to transform gold into mud, the inverse philosopher's stone. Let us take the same example as before, using as the function the square root, the exact inverse of squaring, which is concave, but much less concave than the square function is convex. The square of the expected average payoff is then the square root of the quantity of 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 plus 6 divided by 6 equals the square root of 3.5, here 1.87. The function of the average equals 1.87. But the average of the function is as follows. Take the square root of every payoff, the quantity of the square root of 1 plus the square root of 2 plus the square root of 3 plus the square root of 4 plus the square root of 5 plus the square root of 6 divided by 6, that is, the average square root payoff, and you can see that the average of the function equals 1.80. The difference is called the negative convexity bias, or if you're a stickler, concavity bias. The hidden harm of fragility is that you need to be much, much better than random in your prediction and knowing where you are going, just to offset the negative effect. Let me summarize the argument. If you have favorable asymmetries or positive convexity, options being a special case, then in the long run you will do reasonably well, outperforming the average in the presence of uncertainty. The more uncertainty, the more role for optionality to kick in, and the more you will outperform. This property is very central to life. Book 6. Via Negativa. Recall that we had no name for the color blue, but managed rather well without it. We stayed for a long part of our history culturally, not biologically, colorblind. And before the composition of Chapter 1, we did not have a name for antifragility. Yet systems have relied on it effectively in the absence of human intervention. There are many things without words, matters that we know and can act on but cannot describe directly, cannot capture in human language or within the narrow human concepts that are available to us. Almost anything around us of significance is hard to grasp linguistically. And in fact, the more powerful, the more incomplete our linguistic grasp. But if we cannot express what something is exactly, we can say something about what it is not, the indirect rather than the direct expression. The apophatic focuses on what cannot be said directly in words, from the Greek apophysis, saying no or mentioning without mentioning. The method began as an avoidance of direct description, leading to a focus on negative description, what is called in Latin via negativa, the negative way, after theological traditions, particularly in the Eastern Orthodox Church. Via negativa does not try to express what God is. Leave that to the primitive brand of contemporary thinkers and philosophers with scientistic tendencies. It just lists what God is not and proceeds by the process of elimination. The idea is mostly associated with the mystical theologian Pseudo-Dionysos the Areopagite. He was some obscure Near Easterner by the name of Dionysos who wrote powerful mystical treatises and was for a long time confused with Dionysos the Areopagite, a judge in Athens who was converted by the preaching of Paul the Apostle, hence the qualifier of pseudo added to his name. Neoplatonists are followers of Plato's ideas. They focus mainly on Plato's forms, those abstract objects that had a distinct existence on their own. Pseudo-Dionysos was the disciple of Proclus the Neoplatonist, himself the student of Syrianus, another Syrian Neoplatonist. Proclus was known to repeat the metaphor that statues are carved by subtraction. I have often read a more recent version of the idea, with the following apocryphal pun. Michelangelo was asked by the Pope about the secret of his genius, particularly how he carved the statue of David, largely considered the masterpiece of all masterpieces. His answer was, "It's simple. I just remove everything that is not David." The reader might thus recognize the logic behind the barbell. Remember from the logic of the barbell that it is necessary to first remove fragilities. Where is the charlatan? Recall that the interventionista focuses on positive action, doing. Just like positive definitions, we saw that acts of commission are respected and glorified by our primitive minds and lead to, say, naive government interventions that end in disaster, followed by generalized complaints about naive government interventions, as these, it is now accepted, end in disaster, followed by more naive government interventions. Acts of omission, not doing something, are not considered acts and do not appear to be part of one's mission. Graphic 3 in your PDF showed how generalized this effect can be across domains, from medicine to business. I have used all my life a wonderfully simple heuristic. Charlatans are recognizable in that they will give you positive advice, and only positive advice. Exploiting our gullibility and sucker proneness for recipes that hit you in a flash is just obvious, then evaporate later as you forget them. Just look at the how-to books with, in their title, 10 steps for, fill in, enrichment, weight loss, making friends, innovation, getting elected, building muscles, finding a husband, running an orphanage, etc. Yet in practice, it is the negative that's used by the pros, those selected by evolution. Chess grandmasters usually win by not losing. People become rich by not going bust, particularly when others do. Religions are mostly about interdicts. The learning of life is about what to avoid. You reduce most of your personal risks of accident thanks to a small number of measures. Further, being fooled by randomness is that in most circumstances fraught with a high degree of randomness, one cannot really tell if a successful person has skills, or if a person with skills will succeed. But we can pretty much predict the negative, that a person totally devoid of skills will eventually fail. Subtractive knowledge. Now, when it comes to knowledge, the same applies. The greatest and most robust contribution to knowledge consists in removing what we think is wrong. Subtractive epistemology. In life, anti-fragility is reached by not being a sucker. In Peri Mystikes Theologias, Pseudo-Dionysos did not use these exact words, nor did he discuss disconfirmation. Nor did he get the idea with clarity, but in my view, he figured out the subtractive epistemology and asymmetries in knowledge. I have called Platonicity the love of some crisp abstract forms, the theoretical forms and universals that make us blind to the mess of reality and cause black swan effects. Then I realized that there was an asymmetry. I truly believe in Platonic ideas when they come in reverse, like negative universals. So the central tenet of the epistemology I advocate is as follows. We know a lot more what is wrong than what is right, or, phrased according to the fragile robust classification, negative knowledge, what is wrong, what does not work, is more robust to error than positive knowledge, what is right, what works. So knowledge grows by subtraction much more than by addition. Given that what we know today might turn out to be wrong, but what we know to be wrong cannot turn out to be right, at least not easily. If I spot a black swan, not capitalized, I can be quite certain that the statement, all swans are white, is wrong. But even if I have never seen a black swan, I can never hold such a statement to be true. Rephrasing it again, since one small observation can disprove a statement, while millions can hardly confirm it, disconfirmation is more rigorous than confirmation. This idea has been associated in our times with the philosopher Karl Popper, and I quite mistakenly thought that he was its originator, though he is at the origin of an even more potent idea on the fundamental inability to predict the course of history. The notion, it turned out, is vastly more ancient, and was one of the central tenets of the skeptical empirical school of medicine of the post-classical era in the Eastern Mediterranean. It was well known to a group of 19th-century French scholars who rediscovered these works, and this idea of the power of disconfirmation permeates the way we do hard science. As you can see, we can link this to the general tableaus of positive, additive, and negative, subtractive. Negative knowledge is more robust. But it is not perfect. Popper has been criticized by philosophers for his treatment of disconfirmation as hard, unequivocal, black and white. It is not clear-cut. It is impossible to figure out whether an experiment failed to produce the intended results, hence falsifying the theory, because of the failure of the tools, because of bad luck, or because of fraud by the scientist. Say you saw a black swan. That would certainly invalidate the idea that all swans are white. But what if you had been drinking Lebanese wine or hallucinating from spending too much time on the web? What if it was a dark night in which all swans look gray? Let us say that, in general, failure and disconfirmation are more informative than success and confirmation, which is why I claim that negative knowledge is just more robust. Now, before starting to write this section, I spent some time scouring Popper's complete works, wondering how the great thinker, with his obsessive approach to falsification, completely missed the idea of fragility. His masterpiece, The Poverty of Historicism, in which he presents the limits of forecasting, shows the impossibility of an acceptable representation of the future. But he missed the point that if an incompetent surgeon is operating on a brain, one can safely predict serious damage, even the death of the patient. Yet such subtractive representation of the future is perfectly in line with his idea of disconfirmation, its logical second step. What he calls falsification of a theory should lead, in practice, to the breaking of the object of its application. In political systems, a good mechanism is one that helps remove the bad guy. It's not about what to do or who to put in. For the bad guy can cause more harm than the collective actions of good ones. John Elster goes further. He recently wrote a book with the telling title Preventing Mischief, in which he bases negative action on Bentham's idea that the art of the legislator is limited to the prevention of everything that might prevent the development of their, members of the assembly, liberty and their intelligence. And, as expected, via negativa is part of classical wisdom. For the Arab scholar and religious leader Ali bin Abi Taleb, no relation, keeping one's distance from an ignorant person is equivalent to keeping company with a wise man. Finally, consider this modernized version in a saying from Steve Jobs. People think focus means saying yes to the thing you've got to focus on, but that's not what it means at all. It means saying no to the 100 other good ideas that there are. You have to pick carefully. I'm actually as proud of the things we haven't done as the things I have done. Innovation is saying no to 1,000 things. Barbells, again. Subtractive knowledge is a form of barbell. Critically, it is convex. What is wrong is quite robust. What you don't know is fragile and speculative. But you do not take it seriously, so you make sure it does not harm you in case it turns out to be false. Now another application of via negativa lies in the less is more idea. Less is more. The less is more idea in decision-making can be traced to Spiros Makridakis, Robin Dawes, Dan Goldstein, and Gerd Gigerenzer, who have all found in various contexts that simpler methods for forecasting and inference can work much, much better than complicated ones. Their simple rules of thumb are not perfect, but are designed to not be perfect. Adopting some intellectual humility and abandoning the aim at sophistication can yield powerful effects. The pair of Goldstein and Gigerenzer coined the notion of fast and frugal heuristics that make good decisions despite limited time, knowledge, and computing power. I realized that the less is more heuristic fell squarely into my work in two places. First, extreme effects. There are domains in which the rare event, I repeat, good or bad, plays a disproportionate share, and we tend to be blind to it, so focusing on the exploitation of such a rare event, or protection against it, changes a lot of the risky exposure. Just worry about black swan exposures, and life is easy. Less is more has proved to be shockingly easy to find and apply, and robust to mistakes and change of minds. There may not be an easily identifiable cause for a large share of the problems, but often there is an easy solution. Not to all problems, but good enough. I mean really good enough. And such a solution is immediately identifiable, sometimes with the naked eye rather than the use of complicated analyses and highly fragile, error-prone, cause-ferreting nerdiness. Some people are aware of the 80-20 idea, based on the discovery by Vilfredo Pareto more than a century ago that 20% of the people in Italy owned 80% of the land, and vice versa. Of these 20%, 20%, that is, 4%, would have owned around 80% of the 80%, that is, 64%. We end up with less than 1% representing about 50% of the total. These describe winner-take-all extremiston effects. These effects are very general, from the distribution of wealth to book sales per author. Few realize that we are moving into the far more uneven distribution of 99-1 across many things that used to be 80-20. 99% of internet traffic is attributable to less than 1% of sites. 99% of book sales come from less than 1% of authors. And I need to stop because numbers are emotionally stirring. Almost everything contemporary has winner-take-all effects, which include sources of harm and benefits. Accordingly, as I will show, 1% modification of systems can lower fragility or increase anti-fragility by about 99%. And all it takes is a few steps, very few steps, often at low cost, to make things better and safer. For instance, a small number of homeless people cost the states a disproportionate share of the bills, which makes it obvious where to look for the savings. A small number of employees in a corporation cause the most problems, corrupt the general attitude, and vice versa. So getting rid of these is a great solution. A small number of customers generate a large share of the revenues. I get 95% of my smear postings from the same three obsessive persons, all representing the same prototypes of failure, one of whom has written, I estimate, close to 100,000 words in posts. He needs to write more and more and find more and more stuff to critique in my work and personality to get the same effect. When it comes to health care, Ezekiel Emanuel showed that half the population accounts for less than 3% of the costs, with the sickest 10% consuming 64% of the total pie. Bent Flupiao of Chapter 18 showed in his Black Swan Management idea that the bulk of cost overruns by corporations are simply attributable to large technology projects, implying that that's what we need to focus on instead of talking and talking and writing complicated papers. As they say in the Mafia, just work on removing the pebble in your shoe. There are some domains, like, say, real estate, in which problems and solutions are crisply summarized by a heuristic, a rule of thumb to look for the three most important properties, location, location, and location. Much of the rest is supposed to be chicken shit. Not quite and not always true, but it shows the central thing to worry about, as the rest takes care of itself. Yet people want more data to solve problems. I once testified in Congress against a project to fund a crisis forecasting project. The people involved were blind to the paradox that we have never had more data than we have now, yet have less predictability than ever. More data, such as paying attention to the eye colors of the people around when crossing the street, can make you miss the big truck. When you cross the street, you remove data, anything but the essential threat. As Paul Valéry once wrote, que de choses il faut ignorer pour agir. How many things one should disregard in order to act. Convincing and confident disciplines, say physics, tend to use little statistical backup, while political science and economics, which have never produced anything of note, are full of elaborate statistics and statistical evidence. And you know that once you remove the smoke, the evidence is not evidence. The situation in science is similar to detective novels, in which the person with the largest number of alibis turns out to be the guilty one. And you do not need reams of paper full of data to destroy the megatons of papers using statistics and economics. The simple argument that black swans and tail events run the socioeconomic world, and these events cannot be predicted, is sufficient to invalidate their statistics. We have further evidence of the potency of less is more from the following experiment. Christopher Chabris and Daniel Simons, in their book The Invisible Gorilla, show how people watching a video of a basketball game, when diverted with attention-absorbing details such as counting passes, can completely miss a gorilla stepping into the middle of the court. I discovered that I had been intuitively using the less is more idea as an aid in decision-making, contrary to the method of putting a series of pros and cons side by side on a computer screen. For instance, if you have more than one reason to do something, choose a doctor or veterinarian, hire a gardener or an employee, marry a person, go on a trip, just don't do it. It does not mean that one reason is better than two, just that by invoking more than one reason, you are trying to convince yourself to do something. Obvious decisions, robust to error, require no more than a single reason. Likewise, the French army had a heuristic to reject excuses for absenteeism for more than one reason, like death of grandmother, cold virus, and being bitten by a boar. If someone attacks a book or idea using more than one argument, you know it is not real. Nobody says, he is a criminal, he killed many people, and he also has bad table manners and bad breath and is a very poor driver. I have often followed what I call Bergson's razor. A philosopher should be known for one single idea, not more. I can't source it to Bergson, but the rule is good enough. The French essayist and poet Paul Valéry once asked Einstein if he carried a notebook to write down ideas. "I never have ideas," was the reply. In fact, he just did not have chicken shit ideas. So, a heuristic. If someone has a long bio, I skip him. At a conference, a friend invited me to have lunch with an overachieving hotshot whose resume can cover more than two or three lives. I skipped to sit at a table with the trainees and stage engineers. Likewise, when I am told that someone has 300 academic papers and 22 honorary doctorates, but no other single compelling contribution or main idea behind it, I avoid him like the bubonic plague. Chapter 20. Neomania. Looking at the future by via negativa. The Lindy effect. The old outlives the new in proportion to its age. Empedocles' tile. Why the irrational has an edge over the perceived to be rational. Time and fragility. Prophecy, like knowledge, is subtractive, not additive. The Lindy effect, or how the old prevails over the new, especially in technology, no matter what they say in California. Prophecy, not a recommended and voluntary career. Anti-fragility implies, contrary to initial instinct, that the old is superior to the new, and much more than you think. No matter how something looks to your intellectual machinery, or how well or poorly it narrates, time will know more about its fragilities, and break it when necessary. Here I expose a contemporary disease, linked to interventionism, called neomania, which brings fragility, but I believe may be treatable if one is patient enough. What survives must be good at serving some mostly hidden purpose that time can see, but our eyes and logical faculties can't capture. In this chapter, we use the notion of fragility as a central driver of prediction. Recall the foundational asymmetry. The anti-fragile benefits from volatility and disorder. The fragile is harmed. Well, time is the same as disorder. From Simonides to Jensen. As an exercise in the use of the distinction between fragility and anti-fragility, let us play prophet, with the understanding that it is not a good career choice unless you have a thick skin, a good circle of friends, little access to the internet, a library with a good set of ancient proverbs, and, if possible, the ability to derive personal benefits from your prophecy. As shown from the track record of the prophets, before you are proven right, you will be reviled. After you are proven right, you will be hated for a while, or what's worse, your ideas will appear to be trivial, thanks to retrospective distortion. This makes it far more convincing to follow the Fat Tony method of focusing on shekels more than recognition. And such treatment has continued in modern times. 20th century intellectuals who have embraced the wrong ideas, such as communism or even Stalinism, have remained fashionable, and their books remain on the bookstore shelves, while those who, like the political philosopher Raymond Aron, saw the problems, got short shrift both before and after being acknowledged as having seen things right. Now close your eyes and try to imagine your future surroundings in, say, 5, 10, or 25 years. Odds are your imagination will produce new things in it, things we call innovation, improvements, killer technologies, and other inelegant and hackneyed words from the business jargon. These common concepts concerning innovation, we will see, are not just offensive aesthetically, but they are nonsense both empirically and philosophically. Why? Odds are that your imagination will be adding things to the present world. I am sorry, but I will show in this chapter that this approach is exactly backward. The way to do it rigorously, according to the notions of fragility and anti-fragility, is to take away from the future, reduce from it, simply things that do not belong to the coming times. Via negativa. What is fragile will eventually break, and luckily we can easily tell what is fragile. Positive black swans are more unpredictable than negative ones. Time has sharp teeth that destroy everything, declaimed the 6th century BC poet Simonides of Ceos, perhaps starting a tradition in Western literature about the inexorable effect of time. I can trace a plethora of elegant classical expressions, from Ovid, Tempus edax rerum, time devours everything, to the no less poetic 20th century Franco-Russian poetess Elsa Triolet, time burns but leaves no ashes. Naturally, this exercise triggered some poetic waxing, so I am now humming a French poem put to music titled Avec le temps, about how time erases things, even bad memories, though it doesn't say that it erases us as well in the process. Now, thanks to convexity effects, we can put a little bit of science in these and produce our own taxonomy of what should be devoured the fastest by that inexorable time. The fragile will eventually break, and luckily we are capable of figuring out what is fragile. Even what we believe is anti-fragile will eventually break, but it should take much, much longer to do so. Wine does well with time, but up to a point, and not if you put it in the crater of a volcano. The verse by Simonides that started the previous paragraph continues with the stipulation, even the most solid. So Simonides had the adumbration of the idea, quite useful, that the most solid will be swallowed with more difficulty, hence last. Naturally, he did not think that something could be anti-fragile, hence never swallowed. Now, I insist on the via negativa method of prophecy as being the only valid one. There is no other way to produce a forecast without being a turkey somewhere, particularly in the complex environment in which we live today. Now, I am not saying that new technologies will not emerge. Something new will rule its day for a while. What is currently fragile will be replaced by something else, of course. But this something else is unpredictable. In all likelihood, the technologies you have in your mind are not the ones that will make it, no matter your perception of their fitness and applicability, with all due respect to your imagination. Recall that the most fragile is the predictive, what is built on the basis of predictability. In other words, those who underestimate black swans will eventually exit the population. An interesting apparent paradox is that, according to these principles, longer-term predictions are more reliable than short-term ones, given that one can be quite certain that what is black swan-prone will be eventually swallowed by history, since time augments the probability of such an event. On the other hand, typical predictions, not involving the currently fragile, degrade with time. In the presence of non-linearities, the longer the forecast, the worse its accuracy. Your error rate for a 10-year forecast of, say, the sales of a computer plant or the profits of a commodity vendor can be 1,000 times that of a 1-year projection. Learning to subtract. Consider the futuristic projections made throughout the past century and a half, as expressed in literary novels such as those by Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, or George Orwell, or in now-forgotten narratives of the future predicted by scientists or futurists. It is remarkable that the tools that seem to currently dominate the world, such as the Internet, or more mundane matters such as the wheel and the suitcase of Book 4, were completely missing from these forecasts. But it is not here that the major error lies. The problem is that almost everything that was imagined never took place, except for a few overexploited anecdotes, such as the steam engine by Hero the Alexandrian, or the assault vehicle by Leonardo da Vinci. Our world looks too close to theirs, much closer to theirs than they ever imagined or wanted to imagine. And we tend to be blind to that fact. There seems to be no correcting mechanism that can make us aware of the point as we go along forecasting a highly technocratic future. There may be a selection bias. Those people who engage in producing these accounts of the future will tend to have incurable and untreatable neomania, the love of the modern for its own sake. Tonight I will be meeting friends in a restaurant. Tavernas have existed for at least 25 centuries. I will be walking there wearing shoes hardly different from those worn 5,300 years ago by the mummified man discovered in a glacier in the Austrian Alps. At the restaurant, I will be using silverware, a Mesopotamian technology, which qualifies as a killer application, given what it allows me to do to the leg of lamb, such as tear it apart while sparing my fingers from burns. I will be drinking wine, a liquid that has been in use for at least 6 millennia. The wine will be poured into glasses, an innovation claimed by my Lebanese compatriots to come from their Phoenician ancestors, and if you disagree about the source, we can say that glass objects have been sold by them as trinkets for at least 2,900 years. After the main course, I will have a somewhat younger technology, artisanal cheese, paying higher prices for those that have not changed in their preparation for several centuries. Had someone in 1950 predicted such a minor gathering, he would have imagined something quite different. So, thank God, I will not be dressed in a shiny synthetic space-style suit, consuming nutritionally optimized pills while communicating with my dinner peers by means of screens. The dinner partners, in turn, will be expelling airborne germs on my face, as they will not be located in remote human colonies across the galaxy. The food will be prepared using a very archaic technology, fire, with the aid of kitchen tools and implements that have not changed since the Romans, except in the quality of some of the metals used. I will be sitting on an at least 3,000-year-old device commonly known as the chair, which will be, if anything, less ornate than its majestic Egyptian ancestor. And I will not be repairing to the restaurant with the aid of a flying motorcycle. I will be walking, or, if late, using a cab from a century-old technology driven by an immigrant. Immigrants were driving cabs in Paris a century ago, Russian aristocrats. Same as in Berlin and Stockholm, Iraqis and Kurdish refugees, Washington, D.C., Ethiopian postdoc students, Los Angeles, musically-oriented Armenians, and New York, multinationals today. David Edgerton showed that in the early 2000s, we produce 2.5 times as many bicycles as we do cars and invest most of our technological resources in maintaining existing equipment or refining old technologies. Note that this is not just a Chinese phenomenon. Western cities are aggressively trying to become bicycle-friendly. Also consider that one of the most consequential technologies seems to be the one people talk about the least, the condom. Ironically, it wants to look like less of a technology. It has been undergoing meaningful improvements with the precise aim of being less and less noticeable. So the prime error is as follows. When asked to imagine the future, we have the tendency to take the present as a baseline, then produce a speculative destiny by adding new technologies and products to it, and what sort of makes sense, give an interpolation of past developments. We also represent society according to our utopia of the moment, largely driven by our wishes. Except for a few people called doomsayers, the future will be largely inhabited by our desires. So we will tend to over-technologize it and underestimate the might of the equivalent of these small wheels on suitcases that will be staring at us for the next millennia. A word on the blindness to this over-technologizing. After I left finance, I started attending some of the fashionable conferences attended by pre-rich and post-rich technology people and the new category of technology intellectuals. I was initially exhilarated to see them wearing no ties, as, living among tie-wearing abhorrent bankers, I had developed the illusion that anyone who doesn't wear a tie was not an empty suit. But these conferences, while colorful and slick with computerized images and fancy animations, felt depressing. I knew I did not belong. It was not just their additive approach to the future, failure to subtract the fragile rather than add to destiny. It was not entirely their blindness by uncompromising neomania. It took a while for me to realize the reason. A profound lack of elegance. Techno-thinkers tend to have an engineering mind. To put it less politely, they have autistic tendencies. While they don't usually wear ties, these types tend, of course, to exhibit all the textbook characteristics of nerdiness, mostly lack of charm, interest in objects instead of persons, causing them to neglect their looks. They love precision at the expense of applicability, and they typically share an absence of literary culture. This absence of literary culture is actually a marker of future blindness because it is usually accompanied by a denigration of history, a byproduct of unconditional neomania. Outside of the niche and isolated genre of science fiction, literature is about the past. We do not learn physics or biology from medieval textbooks, but we still read Homer, Plato, or the very modern Shakespeare. We cannot talk about sculpture without knowledge of the works of Phidias, Michelangelo, or the great Canova. These are in the past, not in the future. Just by setting foot into a museum, the aesthetically minded person is connecting with the elders. Whether overtly or not, he will tend to acquire and respect historical knowledge, even if it is to reject it. And the past, properly handled, as we will see in the next section, is a much better teacher about the properties of the future than the present. To understand the future, you do not need techno-autistic jargon, obsession with killer apps, these sort of things. You just need the following: some respect for the past, some curiosity about the historical record, a hunger for the wisdom of the elders, and a grasp of the notion of heuristics, these often unwritten rules of thumb that are so determining of survival. In other words, you will be forced to give weight to things that have been around, things that have survived. Technology at its best. But technology can cancel the effect of bad technologies by self-subtraction. Technology is at its best when it is invisible. I am convinced that technology is of greatest benefit when it displaces the deleterious, unnatural, alienating, and most of all, inherently fragile preceding technology. Many of the modern applications that have managed to survive today came to disrupt the deleterious effects of the Philistinism of modernity, particularly the 20th century. The large, multinational, bureaucratic corporation with empty suits at the top, the isolated family, nuclear, in a one-way relationship with a television set, even more isolated thanks to car-designed suburban society. The dominance of the state, particularly the militaristic nation-state, with border controls. The destructive dictatorship on thought and culture by the established media. The tight control on publication and dissemination of economic ideas by the charlatanic economics establishment. Large corporations that tend to control their markets now threatened by the Internet. Pseudo-rigor that has been busted by the web, and many others. You no longer have to press 1 for English or wait in line for a rude operator to make bookings for your honeymoon in Cyprus. In many respects, as unnatural as it is, the Internet removed some of the even more unnatural elements around us. For instance, the absence of paperwork makes bureaucracy, something modernistic, more palatable than it was in the days of paper files. With a little bit of luck, a computer virus will wipe out all records and free people from their past mistakes. Even now, we are using technology to reverse technology. Recall my walk to the restaurant, wearing shoes not too dissimilar to those worn by the ancient pre-classical person found in the Alps. The shoe industry, after spending decades engineering the perfect walking and running shoe, with all manner of support mechanisms and material for cushioning, is now selling us shoes that replicate being barefoot. They want to be so unobtrusive that their only claimed function is to protect our feet from the elements, not to dictate how we walk as the more modernistic mission was. In a way, they are selling us the calloused feet of a hunter-gatherer that we can put on, use, and then remove upon returning to civilization. It is quite exhilarating to wear these shoes when walking in nature, as one wakes up to a new dimension while feeling the three dimensions of the terrain. Regular shoes feel like castes that separate us from the environment. And they don't have to be inelegant. The technology is in the sole, not the shoe, as the new soles can be both robust and very thin, thus allowing the foot to hug the ground as if one was barefoot. My best discovery is an Italian-looking moccasin made in Brazil that allows me to both run on stones and go to dinner in restaurants. Then again, perhaps they should just sell us reinforced waterproof socks, in effect what the Alpine fellow had, but it would not be very profitable for these firms. There is anecdotal evidence from barefoot runners and users of five-finger-style athletic shoes, which includes myself, that one's feet store some memory of the terrain, remembering where they have been in the past. And the great use of the tablet computer, notably the iPad, is that it allows us to return to Babylonian and Phoenician roots of writing and taking notes on a tablet, which is how it started. One can now jot